Ben, you characterize yourself as one of the few science-based paranormal investigators. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, how does your approach differ by what we see on, you know, a lot of these paranormal investigation programs on television?
As you know, there's no shortage of so-called paranormal investigators or ghost investigators, certainly on TV or elsewhere. Part of the problem is that anybody can call themselves a ghost hunter. It takes no training or, you know, expertise at all to walk around a dark, spooky house, you know, with a camera and flashlights hunting for ghosts. But I think what distinguishes my work and my research is that I take strictly a scientific perspective to it. I apply only scientific methodologies to these mysteries, whether it's lake monsters or ghosts or UFOs or psychic powers or crop circles or miracles or what have you. And because of that, I have a good track record of success. Whereas if you look, for example, at The Ghost Hunters, the TV show, I think it's now in seventh or eighth season or something, those guys have been around for years and years, but if you ask them, you know, what cases have you solved, they don't have much to point to. Every now and then they'll solve a case, you know, they'll find some prosaic, mundane explanation for something that was thought to be a ghost. But most often, they go into an investigation thinking there may be some ghost here or some entity or spirit. And when they leave, when they finish it up, they're no closer to the truth than they were before. They have a couple weird things on video, which could be anything. But at the end of the case, they haven't really solved it. And so I think that that's one thing that really distinguishes good scientific, critical thinking-based investigation from just ordinary people wandering around looking into weird things, is that when you apply science, you find solutions.
Turning to the Chupacabra, what prompted you to begin this project?
Well, I'd always been interested in the Chupacabra. I mean, it's, how can you not love the Chupacabra? I mean, just saying it is cool. Chupacabra. Yeah, I mean, it's just cool. It's a fun monster. It's just so cool. I mean, part of the reason that I was interested in it originally was because I had had a long-standing interest in monsters generally. I had researched and written about lake monsters, for example. I wrote a book called Lake Monster Mysteries with a colleague of mine, Joe Nickel, that was published a couple years back, in which we scientifically investigated lake monsters around the world, including many in the United States and elsewhere. And I'd also written about, you know, Mothman and Bigfoot and things like that. But I hadn't really turned my attention to the Chupacabra. And it's the world's second or third best known monster after Bigfoot and Nessie. It's just known globally and by so many people, and yet so little was known about it. And that was one thing that intrigued me. And the other thing that really intrigued me was that at its heart, of course, the Chupacabra is a vampire. Unlike any other monster that you can think of, other than, of course, Dracula, but certainly no monsters that are suspected or thought to be real. You know, Bigfoot isn't known for attacking people and sucking their blood out. The Loch Ness Monster doesn't do that, etc. And so it was intriguing to me to look at this very modern creature that many people really, really believe exists. It's easy to sort of, in retrospect, after sort of solving the case and going through it, to say, oh, well, isn't this all very silly? No, it's not very silly. There are many, many people around the world, and particularly in Latin America, who sincerely believe that the Chupacabra exists. This is not a joke. It's not like Bigfoot. It's not like an Elvis sighting. To many people, it is a actual real animal that they should be afraid of, either for their personal safety or for these animals. And so that was one of the things that intrigued me, was the vampiric aspect to it.
You talk about that in a cultural context, it was kind of inevitable for the Chupacabra to kind of show up in Latin America. Can you talk a little bit about that and why some of the cultural and social reasons why the monster may have cropped up beginning in Puerto Rico and then traveling on?
If you want to understand the Chupacabra, you have to look at it in its context, its social context and its cultural context. And the Chupacabra is, as I noted, it's essentially a vampire. And you can trace back in my book and elsewhere, I trace back its roots to, for example, the European vampires in the 1700s, 1800s. I also talk about, for example, African vampires and Latin American vampires and South American vampires. And what you find is that the vampire motif really exists in just about all cultures around the world. Even the ancient Greeks talked about vampires. And so the idea, the concept of a vampire is really universal. There's nothing particularly unique about it. However, what you have is you have regional variants. And so a given culture's idea of what a vampire is like is specific to that culture and that geography and that cultural arena. And so in the case of the Chupacabra, it emerged in the 1990s in Puerto Rico. That was where it was first seen and reported. Some people think that Chupacabra came from Mexico, and that's not true. It's entirely and uniquely a Caribbean and a Puerto Rican creature and entity. And when you look at some of the social cultures, some of the social factors that go into essentially creating a vampire and why people think the vampires exist, you see exactly those sorts of social forces at work in Puerto Rico. For example, there's a strong anti-colonial sentiment to vampire stories, the idea that there's some bad, evil, xenophobic entity, something that's foreigners coming in and extracting blood or resources or fat or semen or different things like that, often bodily substances. And this is sort of conceptualized in a given society as a vampire. And so when you look at, for example, Puerto Rico's political situation, Puerto Rico is, of course, owned by the United States, but it's not a state. They've been denied statehood. And so when I researched Puerto Rico and when I actually went to Puerto Rico and interviewed people there, there was a very strong anti-American sentiment. There was this sort of notion that America had been using Puerto Rico for its own purposes and in some ways vampirizing and taking its resources out and not giving anything back. It's kind of a complex thing, and I don't have the time to go into it, but there's lots of interesting cultural aspects that go into it, into, you know, why exactly it is that the vampire emerged, or this particular vampire, the Chupacabra, emerged in the mid-1990s in Puerto Rico.
Well, how long did you actually spend on the research for this book?
I spent about 5 years researching the Chupacabra. Everything from going to, I went to Texas, a place called Cuero, Texas, which is outside of San Antonio, and I interviewed the woman that found the best known Chupacabra in the world, a woman named Phyllis Canyon, for the TV show Monster Quest. I also went to the jungles of Nicaragua in Central America looking for the Chupacabra, a very remote region of the jungle near the Costa Rican border, where, according to my research, of all the places in the world, it was probably the likeliest to house Chupacabras. And, of course, I also went to Puerto Rico. So it was everything from, you know, looking at the folklore, looking at the forensics, looking at the dead animals that had been found, looking at the different types of Chupacabras, interviewing eyewitnesses. I tried to make it a very comprehensive analysis, partly because nobody had done that before. A few writers here and there had written sort of small, superficial things about the Chupacabra, like on one aspect or another, but nobody had really taken the time to sort of try and put it all together and see how it all fit into the larger piece of the puzzle.
Well, let me ask you, what were some of the ideas that you had about the Chupacabra prior to your research?
Well, that's a great question. You know, like everybody else, I had heard of the Chupacabra. I knew it sucked blood. I knew it was supposed to have spikes down its back. And other than that, you know, the only other thing that I knew about the Chupacabra was that it appeared in two completely different forms. And this was one thing that really puzzled me, and it took me a long time to sort of sort out why that was. But if you look at how the Chupacabra emerged, the original version of the Chupacabra, which emerged in August of 1995 in Puerto Rico, was this bipedal, spiky-backed, sort of alien-headed monster. It had large, wraparound alien eyes, again, spikes down the back, long, thin arms and legs, a little bit of fur. And that was essentially what people thought the Chupacabra was in Puerto Rico and elsewhere in the late 1990s. But then what happened was that version of Chupacabra essentially vanished, if it was ever there in the first place, I should add.
Right.
And what you found is that people stopped seeing that Chupacabra. And by about the mid-2000s, a completely different animal, a completely different creature emerged that everyone's calling the Chupacabra. And these were essentially hairless dogs. These were canids, animals from the canid family, which include dogs, coyotes, foxes, and things like that. And these were hairless or nearly hairless animals that appeared primarily in Texas and a few other places. And these were being called the Chupacabra. And so that was one of the things that really intrigued and puzzled me was, well, hold it. How can these two completely different things be called the Chupacabra? And I later sort of made that connection. But it was interesting trying to bring all the different pieces of the puzzle into focus.
So far, the Chupacabra has been claimed to have sucked blood out of animals, but we never hear of any attacks on humans. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, that's the $10,000 question. I think there's a couple reasons. In my book, I talk about that it's possible that the reason that you don't hear about Chupacabras attacking people is the same reason you don't hear about, say, leprechauns attacking people. That is, they're not there. if they were around there, then they would do that. Leprechauns don't attack people. Dragons don't attack people. Unicorns don't attack people. Bigfoot don't attack people, for the most part, depending on who you talk to. So that's one answer is, well, if this creature that everybody is interpreting and thinking it may be real, if this is actually a real creature, then that's a problem. Why wouldn't it attack humans? The chupacabra has been said to attack just about every other animal, livestock, kittens, rabbits, goats, chickens, you know, take your pick. So the question you ask is a very good one, and that's one that the chupacabra proponents have a hard time answering is, why in the world would humans be essentially the only animal that we know of that has never been attacked by people? So that's a good question.
Now that you've written this book, how has this investigation, has it changed your views of the chupacabra or maybe even the people who claim to have had encounters with this creature?
One thing that this whole investigation has taught me that I kind of knew before, but it's just crystal clear to me now, is the ways in which culture influences people's beliefs, and certainly regarding the chupacabra. As I document in the book, you know, there are so many different ways that you can approach the chupacabra. You know, you can look at the dead animals. You can look at it from a folklore point of view. You can look at it from the news media reports and the press reports. And whether you believe the chupacabra is a real animal or not, it's undeniable that it is largely a media-fed animal. It's largely a media-created monster. And I would argue, and I do argue, that the chupacabra, as we know it today, wouldn't have existed if, for example, this woman that originally saw the chupacabra in Puerto Rico in 1995, if she had seen that even 5 years earlier, when there was no internet, it's likely that no one would have heard the chupacabra. So it's very, very much a product of folklore and the mass media effects. That's one thing that I really learned about it. You know, I've talked to, obviously, I interviewed several people who found chupacabras and many of them who really believe they have the chupacabra. For a lot of them, you know, my book isn't going to change their mind. You know, if they are convinced that they have a chupacabra instead of a coyote, you know, I don't know if they read the book or not. I mean, I try and lay it all out there pretty well. You know, ultimately, they're gonna believe what they want to believe.
Well, let me ask you, how do you approach the steadfast believer when you're doing your investigations? How do you approach those individuals?
I try to approach individuals the same way I approach the larger investigation, which is with an open mind. When I went into this investigation, I honestly didn't know what I was going to find. I didn't know whether I would end up finding a chupacabra, for all I knew. You know, so I was willing to follow the evidence wherever it led. And if the answer turned out to be that, in fact, you know, somewhere in Puerto Rico or somewhere in Nicaragua, I, you know, captured or photographed something that could be a chupacabra, that's fine with me. I mean, I don't, that'd be great. In fact, that would make me rich and famous, certainly more famous than writing the book. Ultimately, you know, when I approach the investigation, I have to say, well, hold on here, what's really going on here? And I don't go into it trying to prove or disprove. I go into it trying to say, what is the evidence? And so when I talk to eyewitnesses and when I talk to people who have claimed to have seen the chupacabra and captured the chupacabra, I don't go into it with an adversarial point of view. I don't go into it trying to debunk their chupacabra or say they're wrong. I go into it trying to understand what's going on. What did they find? How do we know that that's what they found? How can we bring science and logic and forensics to address the question, regardless of what they believe? So that's the main goal that I had, is again, not to try and debunk or disprove, but trying to understand what the answer is. And I think that for many of the eyewitnesses and people I talked to, because they saw that I was making a sincere effort to understand, I wasn't ridiculing them, I wasn't making fun of them, I'm saying, you found this weird thing, I don't know what it is, let's all figure this out together.
What was the best evidence that you found, or the most, I should say, challenging evidence that you found that you had to overcome?
Good question. I would say probably the most challenging thing that I had to figure out was addressing what the eyewitnesses saw, because it's incontrovertible that many people, dozens of people, if not hundreds, depending on who you talk to, saw something. They saw something weird. And then the question then is, you know, if you read the book and you say, well, hold on here, if it's not likely that the chupacabra exists, then what did they see? And so I think that to explain to the general public how it is that people can see things that aren't really there, that's kind of a tall order, because, if you don't have a background in psychology, I do have a background in psychology. I have a bachelor's degree in it. So I sort of came to it with some understanding of why eyewitness testimony can be unreliable and why we can see things that aren't really there. But to me, the challenge was trying to explain to the general public who don't necessarily have that background, say, look, you know, I'm not saying that all eyewitnesses are crazy. I'm not saying that, you know, people see dragons, you know, on their way to work. But if you look closely at the evidence, I think if you look at how this is all laid out, I think most people would have to admit that, yes, there are times in which we can misperceive and misunderstand things. And so I think that was probably one of the biggest challenges, was trying to make this idea that we can't always trust our eyes, which is inherently not something that people like to hear. People don't like to hear that we can't always believe what we see. But it's a truth. I mean, it's a psychological fact. And so trying to make that understandable and palatable to the public was probably one of the trickier parts.
Well, I got to say, I see many strange things, but then again, I ride public transportation.
There you go.
So do you think these myths are kind of cyclical? Are they brought on by certain circumstances? And does every generation have a myth?
I think so. Certainly when you're talking about the vampire stories, again, this is one of the things that I found most intriguing, was the very strong vampire connections to it. You know, essentially, as I point out in the book, the Chupacabra is basically just an updated version of the vampire story that's been around for centuries or millennia, updated and within a very specific social and cultural context. And so, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if 100 years from now, 200 years from now, other vampire stories will emerge. It won't be called the Chupacabra, because hopefully I will have put that particular vampire to rest with my book and research, but it'll be called something else, and it'll have some of the same similar themes, and other people may actually have eyewitness reports, and other people may actually have eyewitness sightings of this creature in the future. So again, I think the important part is to sort of put it in context and see why it is that these myths will keep recurring.
So the release of the book seems really timely, since we've had this recent rash of Chupacabra sightings here in the United States as early as just July. So were you involved in investigating any of those stories, and what did you find out?
I investigated a couple of the stories and you're exactly right. This, it seems like, you know, you can't throw a dead cat without hitting a Chupacabra story. Not that I would throw a dead cat. I like cats. But, yeah, there was one in Washington, D.C. In fact, just outside of Washington, there were a couple of hospital workers that found some poor hairless thing that turned out to be a fox that was briefly called the Chupacabra. There was a Texas teenager, a 13-year-old boy in Texas, that shot and killed a hairless creature that was certainly either a dog or a coyote. The DNA results haven't come back yet or not. And I wrote about that for Discovery News, actually. And I got a very cranky email from the kid's mom. And his mother sent me a very cranky, pissed-off email saying that, well, you know, you're just trying to pour cold water on our Chupacabra story, and, you know, our son shot this, you know, this famous mythical creature, blah, blah, blah. I wrote back. I said, look, I'm not trying to rain your parade. If you want to believe that your son killed a Chupacabra, then that's fine. You should just be aware that yours is only one of many, many claims along those lines, and all of them have as yet proven not to be the Chupacabra. So I said, you know, enjoy the publicity while it lasts. You know, have a good time with it. Make a couple bucks off it if you can. But just so you know, almost certainly will turn out not be Chupacabra. If it is, give me a call. We'll talk. I'll add a chapter to my book. But other than that, you know, just have fun with it.
A lot of the many creatures that are being called Chupacabras, we're coming to find out, are just animals infected with mange. Have you done any investigation into that? Is mange on the rise?
Yeah, it is, in fact, and that's an excellent question. And in fact, I suspect that what will happen is that in the coming months and years, reports of animals without their fur, whether they're called chupacabras or not, and certainly in these times, just about any weird animal without its fur is at least briefly called a chupacabra. But that will not only continue, but it will increase. And here's why. With the increase in global temperatures around the world, with global warming, whether people want to think it's man-caused or not is not the issue. The fact of the matter is that everybody acknowledges that, in fact, the Earth is warming up. And because of that, what you have is you have animals that are typically in colder climates that would have died off if it had not been so warm. And so, for example, a wolf or a coyote in, say, the northern United States, say, one of the Dakotas or Canada, if it was infected with sarcoptic mange, its hair would fall off and it would probably die of exposure because, of course, the fur keeps it alive with heat. But because the Earth is warming and because we're seeing higher and higher temperatures, these animals are not dying off. And so animals that we're seeing these days in Texas and elsewhere that have no hair, these are animals that anywhere else they would have died off just as a victim of mange. Again, because they're getting warmer, the climate's getting warmer, they're not dying off, and so they're actually living longer.
We have Shark Week on Discovery Channel. Do you think we'll see a Chupacabra Week or Chupacabra Month?
Chupacabra Week, that would be awesome. That would, sure, absolutely. If they want to give me a call for that, I'll be happy to host the show. You know, the part of the problem is that after a while, you start running out of chupacabras. I mean, there's only so many dead dogs and dead coyotes that you can throw up on the screen before people wise up, you would think. That being said, you know, hardly 6 months goes by when someone doesn't find an alleged chupacabra somewhere, whether it turns out to be a raccoon or a dog or coyote. So essentially, the chupacabra is going to continue to be sighted and reported no matter what. I've done my best to explain and investigate the chupacabra phenomena as a whole in all its different variety and categories. But ultimately, there's going to be people who haven't read the book or who have read it and just don't believe it for whatever reason. You know, ultimately, because the word chupacabra now just means anything weird or any weird hairless creature, people continue to see weird hairless creatures. And so they will continue to call them the chupacabra, even though it's pretty clear there's no connection to any sort of blood-sucking vampiric beast.
Well, let me ask you, what's the subject of your next investigation? What are you going to be working on?
Well, my next, I've actually got two answers to that. My next book is coming out in September or October, and it's a co-authored book with Bob Bartholomew, who's a sociologist, and we are discussing media panics and hoaxes. The most prominent, of course, being Orson Welles' 1938 War of the Worlds, but there's many, many other ones. And so it's a sort of a survey of media panics, hoaxes around the world where people got all crazed and upset about things. And I have a small section on the Chupacabra panic in there as well. And then after that, I've got a book due for the University of New Mexico Press on New Mexican mysteries. I live here, and there's no shortage of weird things here in New Mexico. So I'm working on a couple chapters for that as well.
Well, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us here, and it was a wonderful book. I enjoyed reading it. I'd only heard the sensationalized stories that were, you know, playing across the media, so your book was really enlightening as far as being able to break that down and approach it in a very open-minded fashion. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It was a lot of work, but I figured that, you know, I needed to cross all my T's and dot all my I's and put the case closed on this creature and slay this vampire once and for all.